Today is the day after Valentine's Day. Isn't that right, Mr. Administrator?
That's what
I did. You remember your why?
Yes, ma'am.
What? Could you tell us about it?
You're in trouble.
Well, she is...
Just use some acronyms.
She is babysitting for our grandson in Port Angeles, Washington. So she was planning on being home for the big dinner last night, but she didn't make it.
Oh.
So
what did you have? Tomato soup?
That's what I had. Bisque, I think we called it.
Oh, I see.
She's having too much fun, isn't she?
Well, being with grandchildren is very important.
My grandson is very dear to her.
Very, very, yes. Happy Valentine's belatedly to everyone here today. And today is February 15th, and it's Tuesday morning, and this is the Committee on Veterans Affairs. At this time, I certainly want to recognize all our veterans who are here today. So if you'd please stand and or raise your hand, we would like to honor you. Thank you for your service. We thank you for serving your country and preserving this precious, precious freedom. All right. Today we have an informational meeting. And, however, we have individuals from out of town. And so I think it would be wise at this time to call on these individuals to come forward. Katie Harris. Kathy. Is it Jack Jokel? Oh, good. Yackel with a J. Okay, Yackel. I really massacred that. Please come forward.
Well, I guess I'll go ahead and start. My name is Katie Harris. Not only am I a veteran, I'm a veteran service officer, the assistant veteran service officer for Columbia County. And the reason I wanted to come today was to kind of let you know how my office influences the veterans in our county and what we do. Our veterans populations, per the 2000 census, is 5,703 veterans. I'm a part-time employee. I'm a half position. I work 20 hours a week. For the fiscal year 2003-2004 recoveries, we brought in over $2.5 million into the county through disability compensation and non-service connected pension. This year so far, for this fiscal year, it's a little over $2 million, and I project that the office will generate about $3 million worth of funds into the county. My total caseload right now is around 350 individuals. I service 6.1% of the veterans population in the county. So that's kind of a breakdown of the numbers and how it works. Our funding comes through the county. The county pays $10,000 a year for my office. The Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, the state pass-through, we receive $10,074 this last fiscal year. From what I understand, we can receive up to $12,500, but we haven't received the full amount for over 8 years. In addition to that, I get Medicaid match because I do referrals to Medicaid. The state offers Medicaid match as part of an outreach program that helps fund my budget. As of July this year, this new fiscal year, Medicaid match will go away. So I will lose that resource for funding for the office, which is going to significantly impact the hours that I'm open.
Excuse me, Ms. Harris, Medicaid matches the $20,000 or one of the $10,000?
$20,000, half of my budget.
And it goes away when?
July 1st.
And the reason it goes away?
Is because, from what I understand, there's been some federal guidelines that have been restricted on what qualifies as outreach. Oh. And the state has taken a look at that, and we no longer qualify as an outreach program for Medicaid. So we will lose that funding for our county.
Okay. And could you let us know what is this definition of outreach that we don't quite reach?
You know, I'm not sure of the guidelines and how that works. My supervisor, Jeff Hill, that works, he's over charge of Washington County and Columbia County, and he's got more of the details on how that works. I just kind of get the pass through on it's not going to be there anymore. So I can get that information to you through him at a later time.
Thank you.
So we've broke it down. The cost for the county for the $10,000 that they spend $1.75 per veteran a year in the county. The benefit per veteran through the efforts of my office is $7,365.80 per veteran, which is just significant. If you think of the impact that $1.75 per veteran makes on the veterans in the county.
Substantial return.
Very much so, yes. Mainly I deal with disability compensation. I help the veterans fill out their paperwork and walk them through the process in order to get their compensation, and I do the same as non-service connected pension. I also help with other benefits for education, for medical, for just a whole bunch of other things, death benefits, widow's benefits. There's a lot more than just the disability compensation and service-connected pension that I do in my office. But the main bulk of what we track is the compensation and the pension. We don't track any of the other stuff as far as numbers for how it benefits the county, but I would guess that it would be double that number, and that's the benefit that's coming into the county through all the other programs that we do. I've also brought some veterans with me today from the county that kind of want to let you know what we do as well. So,
we appreciate that very much. So, questions, committee members, for Ms. Harris? Okay. I just want to personally thank you. I think your job is critically important, and I really recognize your dedication to our veterans.
Thank you.
I'm grateful. Okay, next, Mrs. Yackel.
Yes, thank you.
Did I get it right?
You got it perfectly.
Okay.
I'd like to thank you for recognizing all that Katie does. I guess I'm here to tell you what she did for my husband at a time when we didn't really realize we had such a valuable asset in our community. He had a medical diagnosis that was life-threatening and changed our life in a way that we never would have expected. And at that time, he was so busy thinking about potential treatments and going through the recovery period and the additional financial strain that that would create when Katie came into our lives. And instead of it being a lengthy process, getting the paperwork, going through everything multiple times with the regional office, she was available to us in Columbia County. She met with my husband on a Saturday, so he didn't have to miss any more work time than absolutely necessary. She sent him out with a packet of papers to complete and return. She followed through to make sure that he understood everything on the paperwork that needed to be done. We turned it back into her, and in record time, she had turned in his paperwork to all the right places, which was a challenge in itself. And she set up appointments so that he could have all of his evaluations done in just 2 days, and that could be done during his recovery time, again, minimizing the impact to our household financially. She was able to establish a disability and get that money coming in record time. It took the strain off of our household so that he could focus on his recovery and not focus on who was taking care of the bills. And for that, we will be eternally grateful.
And I hope he's doing well.
He is. Thank you.
Great. And we certainly appreciate his position and hope it all works well. Thank you. And Katie will give you a commendation for that. Do you mind, Katie, if I could just go back, how do you define a veteran? How do you know who you're working for? What is a veteran to you?
Well, the definition of a veteran can be somewhat complicated. per regulation, there's a lot of variations that depend on whether you're eligible for benefits. Basic definition of a veteran is someone who has served in the military and have active duty time. In a nutshell, there's lots of complications on whether they've got the honorable discharge, the character of discharge, the length of time they served, whether they're Reserve or National Guard, whether they were called up under Title 10, whether they qualify for veteran status. So it's really a complicated process. We have some people that come into the office and think they're veterans, and actually they're not entitled to any veterans benefits. So,
give us an example of who that would be.
Someone that was in the National Guard for 20 years, but was never called up under Title 10. but was activated by the governor to do things throughout the state, but they wouldn't qualify as veteran status unless they were actually called up under Title X, and they wouldn't be entitled to any benefits through that.
We find it a complicated issue, too, so we're trying to get a better definition. Also, out of the money, the $2.5 million that you brought in to the county, what portion of that would be Medicaid dollars?
That's all state VA or federal VA all money federal. That we track. As far as Medicaid dollars, the way that works, I can give you an example. I've got a case that was on Medicaid, and we just got her pension approved, and the pension amount is for around $1,400. So instead of Medicaid paying that $1,400, she'll have an additional $1,400 to pay for her own care. So that federal money that came through for the VA because of her pension, that $1,400 will be used for the cost of her care, saving Medicaid that additional $1,400. Mm-hmm. So we don't necessarily track in my office how much is saved that way. There was a pilot project done that Jeff Hill was involved with, but my county wasn't involved in that. So I'm not sure on the numbers on how that works. Jeff Hill would be more the person to go to get those kind of numbers.
And why was she on Medicaid initially?
Medicaid initially?
Uh-huh.
Well, the individual was in an assisted care facility and required, because of her income limits, met the needs or met qualifications for Medicaid.
Even though, was this her husband who was a veteran?
No, she is the veteran.
She's the veteran.
Mm-hmm. So through the results of our office, we got her placed on the VA pension. And so that helps supplement her income so she can use that income for the cost of her care, which lowers the cost that Medicaid pays.
And at what age does that kick in, the pension?
For pension?
Mm-hmm.
Pension is another thing that's kind of complicated. In order to qualify for pension, you have to be a wartime veteran. You have to be disabled before the age of 65. By VA standards, if you're under the age of 65, they will do a physical evaluation to determine whether you're disabled. If you're disabled and you meet the income standards, you'll qualify for pension. If you're over the age of 65, there's no disability requirements. It's solely based on your income. But once again, you have to be a wartime veteran in order to qualify for pension. And it's an income-based program.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for either? Well, we thank both of you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We'll now call the, I hope I pronounce this right, is it Chacos? Is that right? Is it Ainsley and Catherine?
I think they're nervous. Let's see what the best is.
I'm Catherine Chacos, and this is my 12-year-old daughter, Ainsley Chacos. And my husband is a veteran, and he's 56 years old. He went to Vietnam, and through Katie's office, he learned that he was 20, not 21, when he was in Vietnam. With Katie's help, I told Katie that he's completed his life, being a veteran, going to Vietnam. If the office was closed, I don't think he would have completed his life.
He's more sociable now.
My husband's much better that he's gone to Katie and has talked to somebody. He's bottled the Vietnam in. But I think keeping the office open is important for other veterans that come through. It will keep the travel time down to Portland. And I'm sorry I wasn't prepared.
But I think you've done an excellent job.
Okay.
It's wonderful to hear it firsthand and without script, pre-written. I mean, because then it's just you know, from the heart and direct to us, and we appreciate it. And,
yeah, my,
and
my
would you let your husband and your dad know that we're so grateful for his service?
Okay. Yeah, he, like I told Katie, I appreciate everything that she's done for us in the last 6 months for my husband.
We certainly wish you the best, and we thank you for being here. And Ainsley, I think you're very brave to come forward at the age of 12, same age as my grandson, and I'm proud of you. And I'm especially proud of young people who will stand up for our veterans. And we need more and more young people to understand, you know, why we get to speak and say what we want and go to church where we want to, and it's because of men like your father and other veterans who have preserved our precious freedoms. And thank you for your leadership.
You're welcome.
And you must be an excellent mother.
Oh, thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And I will call on Brad Parker.
Morning.
Good morning.
I'm a disability specialist in Columbia County.
And would you identify yourself just for the record?
Brad Parker.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm a disability specialist in Columbia County. I work at the west end of the county. And I represent a lot of disabled workers in Social Security Title II disability cases. Most of these people are veterans. And I was asked to refer them to the local service officer, which is Katie Harris. Some of the veterans I deal with are difficult to get in, you know, to convince them to go in. They qualify for benefits. Katie's very efficient, very dedicated. She does a very good job, and all the veterans that I send into her office are very well satisfied and happy. The trouble is that she's not in enough to service all the veterans that I refer in there. It's a lot, especially with Korean Vietnam veterans, very difficult to get them, to convince them to go in, even though they are well qualified. It's to convince them to go in and then only have an office open 2 days a week. It makes it difficult. I would like to see more funding and more time to service the veterans. That's pretty much all I have to say.
We certainly appreciate your being here, Mr. Parker.
Thank you.
Hold it. Wait. Just
what?
Any questions for Mr. Parker? Well, I certainly have one. How many of these individuals whom you counsel are maybe homeless?
I have had three in the past year that basically were homeless, or, you know, one that was definitely homeless living in dumpsters. I had another one in Gresham that I was called down that was, you know, basically homeless, picking up pop cans. Took quite a while to find you and whatnot. But I got him his Social Security disability, and now he has an income and whatnot. But I have another veteran that up there in Goble, Oregon, that was basically living in dumpsters. And Katie brought him to Katie. Katie got him into housing over in Vancouver, and got him treatment, got him cleaned up, and whatnot. He was very thankful, and so was I. But her office, she does a very good job.
Well, we certainly appreciate what you do. Who funds your position?
I run nonprofit. 7 years ago, Social Security asked me to come out of retirement and represent disabled workers because Social Security felt that they were not being properly represented as disabled workers. And I agreed to do it as long as I could do it as a nonprofit business. And Dr. John Garwood of the Veterans Administration contacted me and asked if I would refer veterans, because most of the disabled workers I deal with are from 47 to 57, and that's the bulk of it. It's Title II, and most of those are veterans. So I While I'm doing their Social Security claim, I will refer them. I'll ask if they're a veteran and some pertinent questions to do with the VA, and then I refer them to Katie's office and whatnot. And I have to tell them it's only Wednesdays and Thursdays, 9 to 4, and whatnot. I've got quite a few of them to go to Katie, and they've all really appreciated what Katie's done for them. And that a lot of them didn't even know that service was available in the county. They're always under the impression they have to go all the way to Portland so they don't bother with it and whatnot. But I'm glad her office is there. And I wish it was open more.
I imagine that a lot of veterans wish that also, and their widows or families, spouses. We're looking for an individual, if you should happen to know him, and this, we're on a mission to locate an individual who is a double amputee, and his name is John Mills, and he's in a wheelchair, and we were told at one of our first meetings that he was homeless. We have no way yet to contact him. Mm. But if you ever locate this man or he comes to you, we'd appreciate very much knowing we have several different groups looking for him,
okay.
And we want to help him.
John Mills?
His name's John Mills, and okay. A Vietnam veteran.
Okay, I'll keep an eye out for him.
We will appreciate it very much. Any questions, committee? Thank you very much, Mr. Parker, and we certainly appreciate all your services. And I'll call now on Frank Eubank. Eckrode, I can't read. And thank you for being here, and we certainly appreciate it since you're from my district.
Franklin Eckrode, CW3, United States Army, retired from Yam Hill. I guess this is more for your Washington delegation. I'm a federal retiree. I'm also a disabled veteran. And when you go out to Washington, I'd like you to bring up on our behalf again. Several years ago, they made some headway, but they haven't done it. My retirement is offset by my disability. So basically, I pay for my own disability. I get $210 a month from the VA. $210 a month comes off my retirement. I worked some hard medical issues to be able to retire out of the military, and then found out that unlike any other federal retiree isn't under this criteria, that I have to pay my own disability. And when you talk to our legislatures and your Washington delegation goes out, I think they need to take the final step and include us all and do away with this concurrent receipt law left over from the 1800s. And last thing I have, I want to thank whoever got the idea, the representative or whatever, to form this committee to help us veterans out. And I know I do, and probably all the other veterans do, really appreciate the fact that our legislature in Oregon has now got a committee working for us.
Well, we want to certainly thank you for working for us. And the least we can do is help you secure your future like you've done for us. We're grateful for your service. Are there any questions of Mr. Eckrode? Thank you so much. And we do have this issue on our agenda for the federal delegation, and we won't forget it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify today before we call on Cindy Becker? Okay, if not, we'll ask Cindy Becker, the Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services, to come forward.
Madam Chair.
And it looks like she has James Taves with her.
Madam Chair, while Cindy's coming forward, I'd point out that Senate Bill 10, which is the funding bill for the County Veterans Service Officers, has a hearing at 4 p.m. this afternoon. I believe it's in 50 in today's. I know I'm scheduled to testify in favor of that bill. That is the bill that will provide the funding for the County Veterans Service Officers. And as we've all continued to learn, virtually every agency known to man and woman that affects veterans keeps pointing that the point of entry is the County Veterans Service Officer. And so in order to solve education and health care and retirement issues. It's a critical bill. Whether this is the bill in the end state that comes to the House that funds this, or whether there's another one out of committee, but the first thing to do is to find out how much support we have on the Senate side. And so I do intend to testify in favor of that bill and in favor of that concept, and I'm scheduled to do so this afternoon. And I encourage any other members that have the time or a few minutes, if they can't make it there, to contact the members of that committee too.
Thank you very much. Okay, Cindy, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cindy Becker, Deputy Director of the Department of Human Services. And with me is James Taves, who is Assistant Director for Seniors and People with Disabilities. And what we'd like to do is talk a little bit about Paris and talk about the Medicaid relationship between Medicaid and the County Veteran Services Officers. Hopefully we'll clear up some myths and misunderstandings. We want to make sure that you have the correct information so that you can make whatever policy decisions this committee chooses to make. I'm going to start off and talk about Paris. I don't mean the city, and I don't mean Paris Hilton. I don't know if you have had anyone come before you to talk about Paris. It's a public assistance reporting information system. Paris was started several years ago. Essentially what it is, it's a database in Washington, D.C., run by the Administration of Children and Families that matches various data extract files from states. There are three basic files that are matched. One is an interstate file, one is a veterans file, and one is a Department of Defense file, which has federal retiree information on it. And this is a voluntary program. It's a free program for states. We just became a member or part of the group. There's 28 states who do this to send their data to the data center in D.C. And you can match any one of three files, Medicaid, TANF, which is Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or food stamps. You send on a quarterly basis. You can choose if you want to do it at all. If you're going to participate in Paris, you must submit in August. All states have to submit in August. Other than that, states can choose if they want to submit every quarter or just in August or however they want to do it. The states have a choice to submit all three files, so Medicaid, TANF, and food stamps, just one of the files, whatever they want. And then they can choose which files they want them run against. So they can have them run against the interstate file, the vets file, or the Department of Defense file. So there's all sorts of different ways you can do it. We decided to go for the gold and run all of it. So we took all of our files in November, and the interstate file, what that does is look to see in the field what's called dupes, to see if anyone is claiming Medicaid, TANF, or food stamps in more than one state. And so we sent the extracts of all of our files in. Now what happens on the interstate file, you only get matched against those states that have submitted that quarter. So if three states submitted in a quarter, the interstate file matches against three. If all of the states submit, then your interstate file matches against all of the states. And the vets file, that's a federal file, obviously, and the Department of Defense file is federal as well. So we sent our matches in November, and we received the information back on two of the files. For some reason, something was wrong with the Department of Defense file, so it wasn't run for any of the states in November. So the only thing that the submitting states in November received were the interstate and the veterans. Are you with me so far?
Yes.
Okay, great. On the interstate file, we received about 4,000 what's commonly known as hits, but you have to cut that in half because if they're dupes, then they're shown up twice, once in your state and once in the other state. Anyway, so after going through the data and cleaning up the data, and again, it's just for a certain time period, so it would be interstate matches for October, November of last year. So it doesn't go back years. It doesn't go back months. It's for a very specified time period. It's essentially a snapshot. And so we're at the point now that we have identified, we think, 600 potential duplicates, of which 400 of those are from the state of Washington. We will work those cases with the state of Washington. We will find out where the individual is, in fact, residing. We will, one of the states will claim that person, if you will, and we will then cancel the other file. And depending on the circumstances, we will either go back and try to recover any duplicate payments, but at the very least, we will cost avoid in the future any duplicate payments. So we're in the process of working those cases right now. The veterans file presents a large challenge to us. There were about 5,000 quote-unquote hits. I don't know how many of those came off the Medicaid file, the TANF file, or the food stamp file. I suspect many of those came off the food stamp file. So what we're trying to figure out right now, unfortunately, we don't know how to break the code of the veterans information that we received. So we are meeting with the Department of Veterans Affairs later this week to try to figure out the code information and how that matches against our data. We believe that the bulk of useful information, unfortunately, is on the Department of Defense file. That's got the aid and attendance information. That has the TRICARE and the federal health insurance information. That's not on the veterans file. So we believe that it's the DOD file that will show us, will be the most useful to us to see if there are any matches. And when we're talking about matches, let me explain. On the veterans file, it only shows individuals who are receiving some type of a veteran's benefit. It's not an information and referral. In other words, if Representative Hunt was a veteran and he was not receiving any veteran's benefits, he would not show up on the veteran's file. If Chair Nelson was, even if she was receiving $5, she would show up. So there's been some misinformation that if we just get this veterans file, we can see anybody who's eligible for any benefit. You're only on there if you have to be receiving some kind of benefit to be on there to begin with. What we can do is once you're on the file, we can see if you're receiving, and the veterans folks, county service, can see if they're receiving all the veterans benefits they're eligible for, but they have to be receiving something to be on that. What we would do with that information, assuming we can finally decode it, is make sure that the information that is reported on the veterans file matches the information that we have in either Medicaid, TANF, or food stamps about other income. And so if the veteran, for example, is receiving a certain amount of income that's not reported as income for the Department of Human Services, then we would seek to recover those benefits and offset them against the like we would do with anybody. I mean, anyone who is applying for benefits, it's our responsibility to make sure that we are offsetting the whether it's TANF or Medicaid or food stamps against any other income they might have, regardless of the source. And
excuse me, Cindy, so are you saying that food stamps and TANF help is called income for sake of veterans?
Madam Chair, it's not income, but we would look at income that an individual applying for those benefits might be receiving, and if someone was receiving a financial benefit from another program or their own income privately, we would offset. It's graduated, there's an income test, but we would offset anything that they were receiving against the benefit we are providing.
So, for example, if a veteran was getting has educational benefits, a grant, would you include those dollars?
Madam Chair, I have to be honest with you. I'm not an eligibility expert. There is an incredible formula, and I don't know it has to be actual income coming in. So if they are receiving cash or some other income, a check or whatever, it's what we would be applying against the benefit to reduce the size of the benefit.
housing wouldn't count.
Madam Chair,
they have a home VA home loan. Oh,
no, no. As far as I know, it,
sorry,
it
I,
is.
I wanted to say I owe it some money for using that acronym. We anybody use an acronym, you know, contributes to our Veterans Fund. So okay. There I am. Okay.
We're just like we would do with anybody who comes into the program. We do look at all their potential financial assets, and if they have dollars coming in, we would offset that against the benefit. And what happens with the veterans programs or with any, most of those matches result in cost avoidance. To be very honest, people who are receiving assistance from the department don't have a lot of money. And so trying to recover funds from that were previously paid from low-income individuals is very difficult. We do have an investigation and recovery section, but really what we're looking more for is cost avoiding in the future. And I think there's been some misinformation that if we do these matches, veterans are going to get thrown off of Medicaid, and that's not true. I just want to put that to rest. What we would do again is offset if there was income that we didn't know about that came out through these matches, we would apply that income to benefits, to the benefit. So all it would do is the person would still get the benefit, their income would be applied. We're not going to throw them off Medicaid. We're not going to throw them out of long-term care. And I'm saying that because those are the rumors we've been hearing, and I just want to tell you that's not true. If somebody had an incredible fortune that they weren't reporting, obviously there would be a difference. But I think if they had an incredible fortune, they probably wouldn't be applying for our benefits. So the likelihood of that happening is slim to none.
Excuse me if I could interrupt. So as you're doing this match, if you find out these there are veterans, and I'm assuming here's this whole menu of many available services, benefits that veterans could have access to. So as you do this match and you find out this individual is on Medicaid, but yet he's entitled to various veteran health benefits or assisted living dollars, or what do you do in that case?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is where we need to hopefully explain the difference between what we do and what the county veteran services officers do. We're looking at their eligibility for the Department of Human Services, Medicaid and TANF. So if they, and food stamps, and there are other benefits, obviously, that we provide. If the individual they may be eligible for veterans dollars, we would be working with the county veteran services officers. They would be the ones that would be the front person, if you will, to secure the additional veterans benefits. Just like our main product line is Medicaid, their main product line are veterans benefits.
So as you look at this list, are you going to contact Katie Harris in Columbia County, the current veterans officer at the county, and say, here are seven guys or women who served our country well. They're probably unaware that they have these veteran benefits, and because we see them now on Medicaid. Will you contact them? Is that what you'll do?
Madam Chair, once we get these lists figured out, we are more than happy to share these lists with the county veteran service officers so that they, in fact, can follow up with those veterans. That's absolutely no problem doing that. Part of the issue, though, and I think Katie mentioned it around the Medicaid, and James is certified smart in this, but she is correct in terms of the lack of Medicaid dollars starting July 1 for the county veteran services officers. And the reason for that is in order to claim Medicaid match, you have to have a Medicaid client and do a Medicaid activity. So someone who is eligible for Medicaid, just because you're talking to them and they're eligible for Medicaid, doesn't mean that the body of work is eligible for Medicaid match. That's where our department comes in when we are working with Medicaid clients and Medicaid match. The fact that a county veteran service officer may think the person is Medicaid eligible and refer them to us you're talking, that activity of the referral is maybe a phone call, and that is all that might be eligible in that conversation, maybe 5 minutes worth. Does that make sense? Not the entire encounter between the county person and the veteran.
But perhaps it could also, would you agree, be longer because this veteran might need to find an assisted living home, or, you know, they need to, you know, find other sources, I don't know, of care in his home. So they could spend much more time, even if the veteran's on Medicaid. Would you agree? Mr. Tate, could you identify yourself?
Madam Chair, James Tate from the Department of Human Services. Absolutely. Any activity that's coverable under Medicaid, we can bill for Medicaid match. I was going to say unfortunately. I suppose I would say fortunately, Oregon historically took a very expansive view of how you could use Medicaid match. And even activities where a portion of a person's time was potentially billable, we often ended up billing for the full encounter to Medicaid or much of the encounter to Medicaid when, in fact, you could only pick out a very small time increment that was coverable under Medicaid. And again, it wasn't the county's fault. The state and the counties together, we took this very broad view. What was referenced before, the federal government has not changed the rules. These were always the rules. We were quite a ways out there. And what's happened now is the federal government is sending auditors into every state to look at all the Medicaid claiming activities, and they're very aggressive about this. We've had numerous meetings with the Medicaid people from Region 10, and essentially they're saying if you go back and you look at these things and you clean these things up prospectively, it won't involve any payback to the federal government. So we're across many programs, not just what the veterans officers are doing. We're looking at how we've used Medicaid match, what other opportunities we could use for activities that are truly matchable. But it is causing some major disruption in local programs. We're very, very cognizant of that. But it's not new rules. It's old rules that are being applied much more rigorously than they were in the past. And that's having an immediate effect on the veterans programs across the state come this July.
Mr. Taves, at what point do veterans' benefits exceed the benefits they would get from Medicaid? We're greatly in need of knowing that.
Madam Chair, I'm also not an eligibility expert, but let me tell you in briefly, Medicaid eligibility is predicated on two things, financial eligibility, and we are a 300% of SSI state, and what that means is roughly you can have income up to about $1,700 a month and still qualify for Medicaid and then have $2,000 or less in assets. And then there are things you
does
can still...
Does that include your home?
No, it does not. You can still keep your home. And
it includes your car?
I don't think it includes your car. But there's a series of things it does not include. But that's roughly... so you could, in many cases, have a veteran that gets veterans benefits that still would remain eligible for Medicaid, and we would want them to remain eligible for Medicaid. If they need long-term care, then certainly they're entitled to that, and we would want to have them receive that entitlement. What Cindy was mentioning again is under that amount, then, it becomes an offset. We calculate the board and room, the personal allowance that they're able to keep for themselves, and then above that amount, roughly $580, the rest of their benefit up to the $1,700 level would then go against the cost of care for whatever setting they're in. They could be in an in-home program, assisted living, nursing home, foster care, things of that sort. So the balance of the veteran's benefit then would be applied against that person's cost of care, but they would still remain eligible for Medicaid.
Okay. Could you, I'm probably the only one that didn't follow that. So would you just give that one more time to us, that scenario, just one more time?
Yeah, Madam Chair, it is very complicated. To be eligible for Medicaid, you first have to meet financial eligibility.
Right.
And that is about $1,700 in income or less, $2,000 in assets or less, discounting home and,
right,
and certain necessities. Then, secondly, you also have to be eligible in Oregon for having major needs in assistance with daily living called ADLs. So you need to have need assistance in bathing or toileting or dressing or feeding or ambulation or things of that sort. So we apply the financial eligibility, then we apply the test to see whether or not they need daily assistance to support themselves and whether they need to be in an in-home program or other out-of-home kind of care program. So that's what the eligibility for Medicaid is. Then any other income sources they have within that, after you discount the board and room and what they can keep for their own personal allowance.
Okay, now help me. Just after you discount the board and room, so out of the $1,700 we're talking about right now, so let's say to be in the Roseburg assisted living facility, it costs, $1,600 a month.
They would then apply, what's the exact dollar amount for board and room?
$458.70
to the board and room. They would contribute that directly to the assisted living facility for board and room. They would be allowed to keep, what's the difference again?
$122
for their own personal allowance. And then the balance would be paid essentially back to the state of Oregon against the overall Medicaid payment, which might be $1,900 a month or $1,800 a month or something of that sort.
Madam Chair, if they had additional assets above that amount of money, that's what would come in and offset the cost of care. So
this person who has $1,700 of income, I own a home and a car, and that's it, and I have the same clothes that I had 30 years ago, and nothing extravagant, one cat and one dog. I just want to be sure that I understand this. So I must go to the Roseburg home. Okay. Is Medicaid giving me a $1,700 income or the Department of Defense? Where is that coming from that I qualified for?
Madam Chair, the $1,700 is the income the person has. So to be eligible for Medicaid, they have to have $1,700 or less in income. If they have more than that amount, then they're not eligible for Medicaid.
Okay, so if that's a pension, they're not eligible.
Madam Chair, I think that the $1,700 is the kind of the gateway that gets you in the door. If your income from whatever source is $1,700 a month or less, that plus a disability would could qualify you for Medicaid. Now, let's say you have, Madam Chair, $1,000 actually of income a month, and you come. Your eligibility is determined, and then we work with you, and you want to go to an assisted living. Once you went to the assisted living, $428 of that $1,000 you would pay for your room and board to the assisted living. You would get to keep another $122 a month for yourself for spending money. Then the rest of that, the difference between that and $1,000 would offset the cost of care and would come to the department that would offset against the Medicaid cost, because the facility probably costs $2,000 a month.
Right.
So does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions so far? Let's see behind.
I actually have a question jumping back to Paris. Do you want to wait?
No, that's okay. Go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you for the explanation. I think it's very helpful and clarifying. And I think the approach, as you've described, is very consistent with kind of the broader accountability, government efficiency efforts, especially as we've heard before this committee, so many critical needs, and many of us have introduced bills to try and address those needs. That, I mean, as I understand you describing the program, potentially that will help free up some resources to fund some of these other programs. Looking forward, again, I understand your description about not recovering the cost from the past. I guess two basic questions looking ahead. Do you feel like you have adequate statutory authority at this point to do all the elements of this process that you need to do? To to save the resources going forward and make sure that that we have adequate resources to invest in people in need and other programs. So adequate statutory authority and adequate staff resources within the department to be able to accomplish these goals.
Madam Chair, Representative Hahn, thank you for that question. Actually, the whole area of it's called program integrity, which really looks at investigating, recovering dollars, fraud and abuse. It has a very broad spectrum, and the department is really has a renewed focus on that across the agency. What we found over the years is that we have little pockets of people around the agency who are doing this type of work. And to be honest with you, the veterans work is probably one of the smaller parts of that. I mean, we're really looking at provider audits and recovery investigations, recovery providers as well as individuals. And so we have a renewed focus on it. We are looking at how we can consolidate our resources. We believe at this time that we have sufficient legal authority to go out and investigate as well as recover the dollars and then also to do the cost avoidance. The staffing, what we are doing, and we have a package in our budget or in the governor's budget, we do a cost-benefit analysis. Those staff that are involved in this whole effort bring in probably 2 to 3 to 4 times their salary in recoveries. The main thing is we feel, the state is not trying to bump anybody off of service or do anyone harm. We're just wanting to make sure that we're operating with the best information about assets someone might have so that other people can be provided those services as well. So I think we're doing okay. We can do better, but part of it is a technology issue that we're trying to have our computers talk to each other so we're not reading off of green bars to try to dig out information. And we also don't want to overpromise. There's lots of folks who talk about cost avoidance, saying we can save the state millions and millions of dollars. Certainly, we don't feel that in the veterans program. We think overall we have shown that we can save the state millions of dollars, but I don't want it to be seen as borne on the backs of veterans because it's just not true.
I want to ask Mr. Taves now. Here's my concern, and I've heard this so many times, and I just want to make sure that, whatever we're doing what is in the best interest of the veteran and his family. I think that's the least, we can do. I mean, we owe it to these individuals. We're so in debt to them already. But I want to be sure that an individual is not in a rest home in Medford on Medicaid, and because you find out he also qualifies for veterans benefits, that you go and say, I'm sorry, you can't stay here. We're going to pick you up and move you to the extra bed we have in Pendleton. And because that has been an attempt and moving far away from his family, and I mean, I just think he's been far away already, fighting in wars for us. So, I mean, I just think the dignity of our veterans deserves to be preserved, and they need to stay close to their families. Who has the say-so of whether that individual stays on Medicaid in the home that he would like to be in, close to his family or his roots or other veterans, who he fought wars with? Who has that authority to move him out of there or leave him there?
Madam Chair.
Or her.
We don't move people around because of assets. The assets get applied to the cost of care where they are living. So we would not be uprooting somebody from one place to another because there may be additional assets.
Let me clarify, Madam Chair. I mean, there are circumstances where a veteran may get veterans benefits that, combined with other resources, make them ineligible for Medicaid.
That's a concern.
In that case,
another concern.
In that case, then the person could, because we have thousands and thousands of people in all of our long-term care settings that are there under private pay. They're not eligible for Medicaid. They may end up spending down to the asset and income amount to be eligible for Medicaid, but they're there paying out of their own resources. So a person that gets a cumulative amount of income and resources that may bump them above the Medicaid cap could still purchase services as part of a private pay arrangement, and then if they became Medicaid eligible again later, then Medicaid would kick in. But we wouldn't physically move someone simply because of their change in income.
Madam Chair, I also think it's important, and we certainly agree with your feelings and the committee's feelings about veterans. What we do want to, again, just make clear, Medicaid doesn't differentiate. So if you're eligible for Medicaid, regardless of your assets, they don't have a special category for veterans. Even though we may agree that that would be a good thing, we have to follow the federal Medicaid statutes. And so if they have assets from veterans or any other benefit, we have to apply those assets. Now, again, as James said, that doesn't mean the person has to physically move. It could be that we're applying those assets where they live. If there are too many, they can stay where they're living and maybe become a private pay person. If during the course of being private pay they spend down their assets, they may be eligible for Medicaid again. But we can't carve out special Medicaid laws for veterans. We have to apply them across the board.
So if I'm a veteran and I report to you back to $1,700 of income, and you find that I really qualify for $2,000 of veteran benefits a month, you're going to work off of the $2,000, right? And I'm no longer eligible for Medicaid. Is that the issue? Is that true?
I'm sure that's
the proper
correct
way to look at
that's
this.
Correct. That's correct.
Okay. Yes, Vice Chair Farr.
If I may, thank you, Madam Chair. I think that what Chair Nelson was getting at. In the past, we've had some presentations talking about the veterans' benefit and how it's applied to assisted living or nursing care or a foster mm-hmm. home. And I think that what she was getting at is in many cases, those veterans are receiving Medicaid, and then when their veterans' benefit is identified, their benefit can't be applied to in their current living situation because they don't accept just the veterans' benefit.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware. That's part of the information I think that's been getting confused. If we have a specific individual, a specific resident, we'd be happy to look up that person if something is they think is happening that shouldn't be happening. But we're having a hard time tracking that.
Well, the difference is it's a smaller benefit.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I mean, that's entirely conceivable that you can have a person that is above the $1,700, but whatever the setting they're in, the private pay wouldn't match the amount that it costs to be in that setting. I don't know. I mean, we could certainly look up any individual cases where that occurred. But I do know. I mean, for example, the Veterans Home in the Dells, we literally went in there and got as many people Medicaid eligible because the veterans' benefits would not sustain that home, and the home probably would have had to have closed. And then we struck a deal with the department to get as many people Medicaid eligible who are also still receiving their veterans' benefits simply so they could stay there. So I mean, I think in every single attempt, we would try to keep people where they are and use Medicaid and their private resources as creatively as we can. But of course, at a certain point, you know, federal law and eligibility kicks in, and then our hands are pretty much tied.
But it's important, we want to make clear, it's not an either-or situation. You know, there are many veterans who are eligible for Medicaid who do get some veterans' benefits that are offset the cost of care, but they're still getting both.
You know, as well as these issues, we have a deep concern because, you know, there has never in the history of disability for our veterans ever been a permanent funding source at the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we just feel an incredible responsibility, like Mr. Eckroat said, to, you know, ask somebody in Washington, you know, where's the bank?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here in this state alone, we have 365,000 veterans, and, you know, we have another 4,000 to 6,000 coming home or back. and we're concerned, you know, for benefits. We're also concerned when it comes to Medicaid or veteran benefits at this point that we have mental illness parity. And we know we don't. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, we're concerned. Do we have that benefit from Medicaid through our Department of Human Services for all these veterans who are going to have, you know, tremendous psychological problems to get treatment?
Madam Chair, not to the extent of the numbers returning and the population. We do have mental health services that are part of the Oregon Health Plan for Oregon Health Plus and also for standard population. But again, it's for people who are eligible for those services, and there's not enough.
Well, here again is another one. What I'm trying to do is just, you know, get these points across. We have these individuals. We're just demobbing now, our 3670th group, and, you know, many of them have dental problems, and there's no coverage, but yet we're going to send them, you know, to the Middle East, you know, and I can't think of anything worse than having tremendous dental problems. So I'm just asking, aren't there any exceptions in the time of war to look after the very people that are, you know, having to fight this war? Don't we have any exceptions in statute anywhere?
Madam Chair, again, we have to follow, these are federal statutes, and these are federally funded programs. And until they make a change in that, we can't make a change.
And another point, because it's on my mind, we just found out at our last, I believe it was our last meeting, that there's a new federal program now that groups, what do I say instead of the word group for the Unit Bill Plus, for 3670? I'll say unit, 3670th unit, for example, who just left, has a benefit of 90 days of pre-demobilization health benefits, not only for the soldier himself or herself, but also for their spouse and family. But if the Department of Defense isn't, you know, demobbing these people with a notice 90 days prior to their departure, they have no way to know about it. So we ask, well, then, is that retroactive now that we know that law is in place as of January 1st? Number one, how do you communicate, you know, across the state, and we find out they're not? And secondly, how do we recover, help these individuals recover all of this expense if they have on their own gone out and got their teeth fixed and new eyeglasses and, you know, everything else they need prior to going to war? And here's a new benefit, and it continues, and there are four different options. So, you know, I guess we're just totally concerned about this whole medical plan for these individuals on whom we're placing such intense burden. And it seems to me that somewhere in this law, I see us trade, you know, Medicaid benefits, and we're always getting waivers. And I'm just wondering why we cannot do something to help these veterans the way they should be helped. I mean, what does it take? Should we all get up and, you know, head to Washington and camp?
Madam Chair, I really think it is, you know, as the gentleman earlier talked about, it's really talking with the delegation and looking at what can be done at the federal level.
And, you know, it's like their life insurance. I mean, for $16 measly dollars a month, we can afford every one of these individuals who are risking their life every minute of their day $250,000 of life insurance. And instead, you know, we leave them with maybe $10,000, $12,000. Mm-hmm. So we just have concern. You know, it just seems to me that Department of Human Services and all of our veterans organizations somehow could come together with us and give us, you know, strength for us all to work together to say, you know, this is it. There's no more. No more of not recognizing our debt. And I'm talking about our debt to these men and women who've risked their lives or given their lives. Do you think that's possible?
Madam Chair, we certainly agree with the spirit of what you're talking about. Unfortunately, sometimes, as James said, when we have gotten expansive, we've had to pay back money, and again, it comes out of the state general fund, so it's someone else is going to get less services. If there was a way, we'd be happy to participate in something at the federal level, but you know, we get billions of dollars of federal money that we can't put in jeopardy. And while we absolutely agree with where you want to take this, we're constrained by the laws that we administer for the feds.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds to me as though what you're saying, to some extent, is to the extent that there is an integration between veterans' benefits and other benefits that are available to individuals, it's by accident rather than by design. I know you do your very best to make these things integrate, but from the standpoint of the federal law, any integration is purely accidental. Isn't that the case?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, it's I don't know if that it's accidental. Veterans are not treated any differently than anybody else. So if there are assets, the caseworker will work with them to identify those assets, but they're not treated specially.
Right. So the hole, if I could, Madam Chair.
Yes.
So the holes between where there's no benefits available because of the differences between the two programs, those are the result of federal law. You have to enforce the federal law because that's where the funding comes from. And so in a sense, I guess we can say that it's the federal government's responsibility to look into and to make sure that these holes that Chair Nelson is talking about actually get filled. Would that be a fair summary of what you're saying?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, we're not trying to cop out of anything, but yes, that is correct.
All right. Thank you very much.
Cindy, for example, the 4,000 to 6,000 additional count of veterans coming home, you know, really probably amounts to 16,000 individuals at least with their families, you know, their spouse. How on earth, with only what do we have? We have these part-time county veterans officers. How on earth can 34 of them possibly handle, you know, this workload? And you know, what's DHS doing about it? Don't you have some funding that you can help? I mean, it's for human services. I mean, don't you have some funding? Have you put some in the budget to help us? I mean, one-tenth, of an officer, and, you know, like we've heard, 20 hours a week isn't cutting it.
Madam Chair, I don't mean to be bureaucratic, but the county veteran services officers are part of another department. The governor's budget, 40507, for our department already has between $350 and $400 million worth of cuts to services to people who are currently being served throughout the state. There are no additional funds that we have for this population, unfortunately.
Right. Representative Boquist.
Madam Chair, I want to go back just to get a quick clarification on the eligibility. We talked about cash dollars, and I think everybody's clear on that, but there's a third component which you mentioned, and could you briefly describe, if you'll indulge me, Madam Chair, and Cindy, give us the parameters of changes within the federal statutes or the interpretation of the federal statutes of the physical need. I believe what we've said, I believe what's really happening is we've decided that the broad spectrum of what that physical need is on a day-to-day basis has had to collapse down. And could you address that specifically? Of what parameters have we shrunk down? By shrinking the parameters, therefore, people are becoming eligible. Could you give us a brief explanation, Cindy?
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, we can give you a brief explanation, but I think we can also provide you with materials that we are providing to our Ways and Means Subcommittee that specifically speaks to levels of impairment and the continuum between starting with level 1, was it level 17, it's been cut back to level 12?
13.
Level 13. And rather than try to explain this, I'm a pretty visual person, and I think if we just give you that information, you can go through that, and we'd be happy to come back and speak to it.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Madam Chair, follow up.
Yes.
I think many of the issues, fellow members of the committee, that we hear about and have heard about don't fall into the $2,000 asset category. They don't fall into the $1,700 income category. They fall into the narrowing of that focus, yeah. Which means we had people out on the edges, regardless of dollar values,
right.
On the left and right edges, who have no longer eligible for the program. And I think many of the single cases we have seen fall into that category.
Madam Chair, Representative, in many ways, Oregon has transcended many of the federal constraints in the Medicaid program. And Oregon has historically developed one of the best long-term care systems in the country and was very expansive, able to serve even people with minimal needs. I mean, minimal needs are significant if it affects you on a daily basis. And you're absolutely right. I mean, as the budget constraints have come down over recent years, that eligibility keeps getting ratcheted down. I think we're stabilized now. We're not proposing to decrease that eligibility for the physical needs anymore, but it's significantly down from where it was. And then also in the federal Medicaid budget, some major changes are at least being proposed that will change match rates and will further limit our ability to serve an expanded population.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Additional question that I intended to ask earlier and didn't get to. One of the things that we've learned today, I think, very clearly, is that the needs that people incur over time continue. But we've heard testimony that, and you were here for that, mm-hmm. Of people who served in the Vietnam War who are in need of services now who may not have needed them earlier. I think it's reasonable to assume that there are people who are in Iraq today who will be needing services when they get back 6 months later, 10 years later, 30 years later.
That's right.
I think those assumptions are quite obvious at this point. Many of them are mental issues, mental health issues, but there are other kinds of issues too. There's some physical health issues that don't show up until people are much older. Things that become chronic over time. I'm wondering if within your department you believe that you have the sufficient resources to identify the people who are in need of services who would qualify under the services that you provide, and I'm just trying to distinguish those from veteran services now because you've made that distinction, whether you have the adequate personnel to do that, whether you have an adequate screening system to actually identify the people in need. And whether, and I'm going to add to Representative Boquist's question, whether we're actually serving the people who have the needs, given the limitation on the definition of disability that are eligible. I've asked a compound question, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, let me start out, Madam Chair, and Representative Barnhart and James can fill in. Identifying the need is less of an issue than serving the need.
Yes.
And particularly in Oregon, we know that the demographics of Oregon are such in terms of the aging of our population that over the next 10 years it's going to increase at a significantly faster rate than the general population, veterans, non-veterans alike. And our resources, we also know that the state's budget is not going to keep up with that growth either. So we're going to have to make some tough decisions going from a system, particularly a long-term care system, which has been heralded across the country for its innovation and its expansiveness and its freedoms of choice, to one that is much more constrained based upon the dollars that we have available. It's not a question of the federal dollars. It's a question of the state match, which is required to draw down those federal dollars. Those are significantly decreasing, and it's starting with, well, it started actually the past 3 years when the department has cut $900 million of state general funds since 2002 across, and that also cuts at least that amount of federal funds. So we've taken over $1.8 billion worth of cuts in the past 3 years. That is continuing over the next biennium, and we suspect it will continue at the same time that those individuals in need, as our resources are going down, and you know how it works with the economy faces a crisis, a demand for our services goes up, our resources are going down, so it is almost the perfect storm. So what we are looking at is ways in which we can look at how we do our work. Since we're not going to get more resources, can we do things more efficiently? Are there some things that we can do to be able to take the existing staff to enable them to take on more work, knowing that we're not going to get more staff? So we're looking at process improvement and re-engineering, and how do we re-sculpt, I guess, the way we provide our services, so that in fact we can use savings in administration rather than in program. But even with that, we're not going to stem the amount of cuts that we're going to have to take over the next biennium. Obviously, you know that our agency is 25% of the state's general fund with education, so it's we can't keep up with it.
Okay. Follow up.
Maybe more than you wanted to know.
Thank you. And now this gets to the next point. Your funding is in almost every program has state money involved in it, either as a match or as the entire funding for the program. Veterans programs, on the other hand, for the most part, are entirely funded by the federal government. That's correct, isn't it? That being the case, we have an interest when we can. And when we can do it reasonably, to make sure that we identify the veterans accurately, and that we actually identify accurately what the benefits are that they ought to be receiving from the federal government, because it reduces the impact on the state funds.
Correct.
Would that be an accurate statement?
That'd be correct.
Thank you.
Representative Barr.
Madam Chair, this may be a bit of a follow-up to Representative Barnhart's question, but going back to something you said earlier, you don't track the number of veterans that the department currently serves, or do you have an accurate account of the veterans that are receiving benefits from your agency?
We have information on long-term care, and James can provide that. We don't have information on other benefits like food stamps and regular OHP or Medicaid.
But, Madam Chair, Representative Farr, just in long-term care, we serve about 1,147, as of last month, individuals that receive veterans benefits. That may also include survivors, so it's not just vets, but it's some level of veterans benefits within that pool.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, what we will be seeing from this veterans file, as I said, that we received, is once we get that cleaned up, that will show us how many veterans are receiving benefits in any of those three programs.
And so you will be tracking that data?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, I'm not sure what you mean by tracking it.
Well, will you be compiling it so that at a later time, if this committee asks for you to present the data, how many veterans are in long-term care, how many veterans are receiving food stamps? Would you be able to provide that?
Representative Farr, we will be happy to provide whatever we get out of this match.
Thank you.
I'm not sure of this, Mr. Pace, but our number of these 1,147 veterans part of Project Independence?
I believe it was in Medicaid only. Madam Chair, that was in Medicaid only, so there could be others served through OPI. And
okay. Would it be possible, I see Jeff and Zimmer here, would it be possible to get that information? Is it possible to find out how many veterans are on OPI? Oh, Mr. Taves, you and I both have to contribute to the Veterans Fund today. Did you say OPI?
Yeah, yeah.
No, say no.
Madam Chair, we think OPI is a word.
OPI. Okay, we'll call it OPI. Okay.
That is a good bureaucratic answer.
I'm also a good banker, so I'll keep count of this, Mr. Tate. Jacqueline, could you come up and just take the microphone for 1 minute and identify yourself and tell us if we can identify these individuals?
Madam Chair, Chair, members of the committee,
Oregon Project
for the record,
Independence.
Jacqueline Zimmer with the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And I'm, to be honest with you, I'm not certain, but I will certainly ask my directors today. We'll do a quick survey and see if we can get an answer for you by tomorrow to let you know. I'm certain that in our smaller areas, the more rural areas of the state, we'd probably have an easier time of extracting that information. In our larger areas, it might be a little more difficult, but we'll try to ballpark that for you.
Okay, would you please, but for our sake of comparing at this moment, could you tell us what does it cost to stay at home and have, you know, assisted living under Project Independence? A typical case, if there is such, I mean, is it $400 I would get if I stayed at home versus spending $6,000 to go to an assisted living facility? I mean, is that an appropriate comparison?
Well, Madam Chair, Oregon Project Independence, the amount of service that we provide under Oregon Project Independence has sort of been ratcheted down along with the funding over the last couple of years. At one point, we had about $17 million in Oregon Project Independence, and we could serve little around, somewhere in the ballpark of 8,000 people. And now I believe there's about $8.6, $8.7 million in Oregon Project Independence, and we are serving
3,000.
a little in the 3,000 ballpark of people in that program. The administrative cost for Oregon Project Independence is quite minimal, and it's true that there's no federal match for Oregon Project Independence, but it also means that there's less sort of federal bureaucracy to be managed as well. So the administrative costs, I believe in the survey that we've done, it was around, it comes to around $10 a month once someone's enrolled. Is that in the ballpark? I think that's about right. So the majority of the care comes down to services. The majority of the spending comes down to services. So some people get around $150, around $200. I think that's the ballpark number that we're using, about $200 a month for services under Oregon Project Independence.
Per month in an assisted living facility.
If you were in, if you were being served at home under the Medicaid program, then those costs are, I'm saying around $950 per month. But you're also getting the Oregon Health Plan if you're using a Medicaid service. The Oregon Project Independence, there is no access to the Oregon Health Plan. You're on your own there if you're in kind of low income. So there's a substantial difference right there. If you're in a nursing home, my recollection of basic nursing home care is about $4,100 a month. So the state has a portion, a responsibility for a portion of that, most of the people in nursing homes are pretty impaired. It's a
20%.
No, Madam Chair, anything under the Medicaid program, the state pays about 40%. The federal government matches it about 60%.
Right. So around 1,800 or so, depending on your kind of your level of impairment in a nursing home. So, but the difference is, in Oregon, people in nursing homes are fairly impaired, and when you start moving into assisted living facilities and so on and so forth, your impairment levels are probably a little bit higher than they are if you're in at home. But there are some people who do live at home who are very, very impaired, but who still have enough sort of natural support and state and OPI, Oregon Project Independence support, to make it. So.
And could I ask, do any of you three see us moving more toward the plan where a spouse could be compensated, choose to stay at home, and our sister, brother, or grown child, and take care of this individual, be far more economical than placing these individuals out of their home and where their garden is and where they raise their kids and chickens? Are y'all working on this program at all?
Madam Chair,
different ways.
Keeping people at home has always been our top priority. We still serve about half of the long-term care population at home. With spouses, it's a very small number, mainly because the federal government simply will not allow us to use Medicaid for spouses. But otherwise, for relatives, neighbors, friends, people from the church, I mean, there's many, many close relationships where we actually fund that relationship under the Medicaid program to provide
that
support at home.
Child?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. A brother, sister?
Absolutely.
But just not the spouse?
Just not the spouse.
Madam Chair, the issue for us over the years has been, again, the sort of whittling down of the use of those services. The spousal pay care program is capped at, is it 180 families in Oregon can use the spousal pay care program. I'm trying to remember what the number used to be. The issue that we found of interest in the spousal pay program is that a number of the spouses that are actually providing the care could benefit from our help as well. I mean, it's very interesting to see people that are very impaired actually taking care of their very impaired spouses, but they tend to be some of the best providers of care because they really do know the day in and day outs and how people like to be moved and cared for, and they're more tolerant maybe sometimes of cranky behavior that comes along with pain and so forth. So it was unfortunate a number of years ago when you watched that program be whittled down to 180. And then the relative foster care is one of the issues that the governor has, one of the topics the governor's chosen for elimination in his budget. And I think there are 2,000, for some reason I thought there were 4,000 at one point, but there are 2,000 or so.
Almost 2,000, yeah.
Folks that we are paying. So perhaps, Madam Chair, I might take in an elderly aunt and provide care for her. And in doing so, I would no longer go out and work in the community, probably. In which case, I'm not. I'm actually providing that care, and it's about $850 a month. That's about the average cost per case. It's being eliminated, right? And that's pretty much what our entire budget looks like. Every single one of our programs is under the same sort of. We are big users of the general fund. There are a number of people in Oregon who use and need long-term care services between seniors and people with disabilities. So we're a big target. But that's a program that we hate to see go away too, because the reason that Aunt Louise is in our home is because she needs significant care, and it's entirely possible she doesn't have a home to go back to, so that's one of the reasons she's living with us. So,
Representative Farr.
Jacqueline, may I ask this question? So you're saying that for $850 a month, we're paying a relative to care for their elderly aunt or
parent.
And these would be elderly people that couldn't live alone. So if they couldn't live with a relative, then they would probably be in a nursing facility.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, some other arrangement, it's possible that the family would decide, in fact, to forego the income and keep the relative, and I think that you can kind of bank on that. But it's also possible, it's quite obvious that a number of them will come back into the system at a different level of care, whether it's just a foster care system where there are five people in a home or assisted living facility. Some of them might go into a nursing home. It's possible that will be the outcome for that.
Can I ask what the cost of a foster home would be?
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, it depends upon people's level of impairments, but I'm going to kind of turn to James, but that's, again, it's around a...
Chair, Representative Farr, it's generally between $900 and $1,600 a month, depending on the level of impairment.
You could add on for certain levels of impairment in a facility. So you could double somebody's cost of care every month simply by moving them out of that facility.
Well, that's what I was getting at. And then follow up, Madam Chair, if I may. Does the federal government have a portion of the foster care allotment that they pay?
Yeah.
And what typically is that?
Same, 60-40.
60-40. Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Farr, all of our programs, with the exception of Oregon Project Independence and the spousal pay, are matched with federal dollars. And... So Oregon doesn't spend a whole lot of its own sort of money on paying for programs. It pays it. Most of them are just the match.
So the relative foster care also receives a match, or is that entirely funded?
Representative Farr, it does receive a federal match. So the state's cost for that, if a case is $858 or say $900, is around $400 per month. That's a ballpark.
Representative Ford, these are all part of the home and community-based care waiver that we received in 1981. All of these services are alternatives to long-term care, particularly nursing facilities. So the federal government does participate in the cost of those for Medicaid-eligible individuals at risk of going into a nursing home.
But if I may, Madam Chair and Representative Farr, to follow up on that, and Representative Boquist made this point earlier, in the last round of reductions that the long-term care services system endured, we did eliminate services for people at levels 13, 14, or actually went down to level 11, and 12 and 13 came back during the interim. So there are still people at levels 14, 15, 16, and 17 who lost services. Some of those people were seniors, and they were able to turn to Oregon Project Independence for some support. Remember that Oregon Project Independence was sort of reduced as well. But younger people with disabilities, the 18 to 64 crowd, MS, stroke, accident, this sort of crowd, they didn't have an Oregon Project Independence to turn to. And they were too young for Oregon Project Independence, which is why we're promoting sort of the expansion of Oregon Project this year, Oregon Project Independence this year, to include people with disabilities, to include a place for us to promote long-term care insurance, to create a website so that people could seek information about care out for themselves or their family, and to open up our offices to help people put care plans together for seniors and people with disabilities. Sort of help to help deal with the coming numbers, but also to deal with the people who've lost services.
I cannot present to you at this moment the statistics, but I'd be happy to find the detail. But we understand our Oregon veterans receive anywhere from $118 or $181 per soldier to over $700 per soldier less than veterans in other states. And I'm just on a mission to find out why. And I keep seeing it in these programs somewhere. And I'm saying, you know, since we're not getting federal dollars like we should for our veterans, but yet we're getting it in these match programs where there are some veterans already, I'm greatly concerned about us losing matching funds. So, Cindy, since you used to be one of the chiefs in that Department of Administrative Services also, where are we on the loss of matching funds in the budget as we see it today for human services, health and human services?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the match rate is about, it's almost 2-1, so every time you cut a state dollar in the Medicaid program, you're losing $1.57. In other programs, you're losing, you know, $2 of federal funds. So you can usually at least double that. There's only about 20% of our budget in human services that is not matched with some type of a federal dollar. So the reductions that we're looking at are, as I said, about $370 million in general funds, so double that for federal funds that we would also lose.
Madam Chair.
So we are losing $750 million because of the program cuts that have now been set forth in the Department of Human Services budget for this next fiscal year.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Basically, with the dollars that we had available, there were no easy cuts left. There were no easy choices left. And
$750 million for the next biennium.
Madam Chair, that's about correct. I can get you the exact figures.
Federal funds that we are...
Well, it's not
passing on.
If you, Madam Chair, it would be another $400 million of federal funds, not the $750. The $750 would be if you added the general and the federal. So it would be about $400.
Okay, I misunderstood then, because I thought that we cut the budget for Department of Human Services $370 million.
Of general fund.
Of general fund. Mm-hmm. Okay, and our match is what?
It's about $1.50, yeah, that goes
so
into
which
the
would
Medicaid.
Be about $7.50.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions? Do you have some ideas for sources of permanent stable funding outside of raising anybody's taxes as our, you know, public has clearly said, you know, we ain't got no money left.
Madam Chair, if I had that idea, I'd be out consulting.
Okay. An acronym fund. Okay, that's a good one. Okay, any other questions? Representative Boquist.
No, Madam Chair, I just have a comment. It goes back to your question, and it actually, I guess, bails Cindy out here. You can't get a federal matching fund. You cannot increase the amount of money available for veterans unless you can identify the veterans. We're back at square one, the county veteran service officers, who are the people who can say, this is the veteran, he needs to go to this agency. Until he goes to, whether it's Department of Human Services or to the Veterans Administration or anybody else, until we open the gate, at that point, we're not going to identify more veterans that are eligible for more benefits. Okay. And when they're eligible for more benefits, then there's the matching dollars for the federal government. So the gate is closed at the county seat. And it's not the county's problem. It's this committee and the Senate and the House are responsible to fix it and open the gate. And then the resources will be available without pressing the taxpayers of the state of Oregon further. That is the gatekeeper, the County Veteran Service Office right now.
Well, excellent. And also we've been told that we need an additional five ombudsmen just to work on, you know, veteran issues, even beyond, you know, the medical and pension benefits. So, you know, we have 34 part-time right now, partly funded officers, as well as the five or six here with the Department of Veteran Affairs. I cannot even fathom how, and I thought I have been spread thin in my life, how these individuals can handle 365,000 plus, so let's make it 370,000 veterans and their spouses and their children and all of the various components of their, you know, needs, from education to medical to, you know, pension, housing. It's just beyond my comprehension. So I just cannot imagine that we'd be a state government that would not step up to the plate and said, this is it. We are funding those positions adequately to take care of these men and women who've taken care of us. So I hope we can enlist your support and certainly the governor's in saying, you know, I'm not going to turn my back on the veterans one more time. We approved in the last legislature $1 for the veterans to open the last wing of their home that had never been opened, that would hold 50 other patients. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Committee, the state has yet to pay them that $1. And it's 2 years later, so something's the matter. You know, it's back to priorities. Mm-hmm. And if there was ever a time, we're going to, you know, shape up for those we shipped out, it's now. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. When you're identifying those that qualify for your services, do you routinely ask if they also qualify for veterans' benefits?
Chair, yes. We check all their resources, correct.
Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair, if you're done with this part of the meeting, I could tell the members what we have distributed here from the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Okay, let me just thank these members.
Thank you.
Cindy, I can't imagine your broad background to know so much here in our state, and we thank you for your service, and Mr. Caves and Jacqueline. Of course, we always appreciate your concern for our seniors and disabled.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here. Okay, Mr. Minister,
Madam
finish
Chair,
this meeting.
The Department of Veterans Affairs has provided you information again based on questions that you asked in the past. Representative Farr noted that the second item in your packet here on Oregon Veterans Home Resident private pay rates and profiled payer sources at the Oregon Veterans Home might be especially relevant to today's information. Everyone should have a copy of that, right?
Mm-hmm. This one, everybody has? Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
I don't know if you want to do this.
Is there any other business or comments any of you would like to make, Representative Comp?
No, I was just wondering about our field trip on Thursday.
Yes, we're set for the field trip. We can just meet here at 8:30. They're going to pick us up right outside just after 8:30, and we will be back by, I think it was 10 o'clock, we said.
Appropriate attire? To make any other committee. Is it going to be cold?
I think yes. It will be approximately like today.
Okay.
We'll be outside.
I can make a comment only in public.
We'll be outside.
Where are we going?
Inside. We're going to two facilities that the veterans, military department runs. One is the Readiness Center out on State Street, and one is the military headquarters,
okay,
which is on Airport Road. They're going to give us an idea of the kinds of transportation that they have available for members of the military and National Guard. They're going to pick us up in their bus.
Okay.
Well, that's what I was wondering about attire.
Well, I think Representative Comp was asking if we're going to be outside for extended periods.
That, inclusive of that?
I think we will not be outside for extended periods.
Okay.
Last time I was there, though, it was raining exceedingly continuously and hard.
Any other comments?
I particularly want to just take this moment to thank each member of this committee. It is absolutely the very best committee we have in this building. Your commitment to the issue, your attention, your respect is incredible, and we certainly know your mission. I just want to thank you, and we couldn't have two better administrators, Aaron Seiler and Jim Stembridge. So thank you, and thank you for being here today. The meeting is adjourned.